Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Welcome to The Ugly Radio on the Podmoth Network, a lo-fi sci-fi audio theater anthology series made for late nights and strong drinks. Join us monthly as we broadcast a pirate signal across time and space, featuring stories, songs, and frequencies from a rotating list of voice actors, writers, storytellers, and musicians. If you're looking for high-quality science fiction, skin-crawling horror, and other genre fiction, listen to The Ugly Radio on the Podmoth Network, now available wherever you get your podcasts. The Ugly Radio. See you in the void.
Curfew is in full effect. Everyone lock your doors and don't answer after midnight. Early on Wednesday episodes are about to be released.
Tell us about your encounters with Early on Wednesday.
Ladies, this is Natasha with Cryptids, Creeps, and Conspiracy. You guys are great. I mean, you're funny. You're very interactive with people, both on the pod and through social media. And your guys' detail in your episodes is great.
I think it's pretty awesome.
Stacey and Lavender keep you very engaged in the topic.
And you guys make me laugh throughout my day when I'm having a crappy day.
You heard it here first. Stay safe out there, ghouls.
Welcome to the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes, bizarre occurrences, and get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories. To lighten things up, we'd like to end our time with a chaser. Please keep in mind some of our stories might be upsetting to young or sensitive ears.
We love hearing from our listeners, so feel free to contact us by email or social media. You can find our contact info in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to support us through Patreon, you can find us there at Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast, or use the link in our show notes.
Welcome back, everybody, for another episode of Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast.
Yes, thanks for joining us once again, friends.
Declan, what story do you have for us today?
Today I'm going to be talking about the Urals Monster.
Urals Monster. Okay. Interesting.
It's a story out of Russia. What about you? What story do you have for us today?
Well, I'm going to take you back to World War II, and we're going to be talking some wild history from a proposed effort to get in the minds of our, at that time, enemies. It's a wild one.
Well, it's weird. My story actually predates World War II.
Oh, so we're both going old school.
Which is, yeah, we're go both going old school.
Right.
That's right.
Nice. To go with my story, I brought the Man of War cocktail. The ingredients are 1.5 ounces of bourbon or rye whiskey, 1 ounce of Cointreau or other orange flavored liqueur, 1/2 ounce of sweet vermouth, and 1/2 ounce of lemon juice. Steps are to chill a coupe glass, add all your ingredients to a shaker with ice, shake well, and then garnish with a cherry and a lemon peel. I used bourbon for mine.
So I just want to say the Portuguese Man of War jellyfishes are terrifying. So hopefully this cocktail tastes better than that. We don't have to pee on ourselves.
Right.
Which I also heard is false.
I don't want to pee on myself, but I have a feeling this is not going to be a very good cocktail because I smelled it when I was making it. And I was like, oh, that smells like paint thinner. I think it's because of the vermouth. It's not a lot of vermouth, but...
Yeah, it.
Okay.
He's funky.
We'll try it. Okay. It's decent, actually. Mm. It's not bad. I was scared about the vermouth, but it's really...
I don't think I'd make it again, but...
No, probably not, but I think I'll drink it. Because I don't want to waste the bourbon. That would be a shame.
Yeah, gotta finish it. But so, speaking of Man of War, I just want people to know that their tentacles average around 30 feet, but potentially reaching up to 165 feet.
That is,
and they have
horrifying.
No propulsion; they just float around in the water.
And I don't like it.
I think they can kill you.
Yeah, you think so? Wrong,
but
I don't know. I don't like it. Ugh. Thankfully, my story...
They float on top of the water because they're filled with gas. They're freaky.
Ooh. My story is not about jellyfish. It is about an animal, but okay. It is not about jellyfish. Much less terrifying than a jellyfish that's going to sting you and maybe kill you.
One last jellyfish fact.
Yes.
Sea turtles eat them, which is weird.
Go sea turtles.
They don't get stung at all. They just go and chomp on them.
They're like snacky snack. It's a little appetizer for the day.
It's a free buffet. It doesn't swim away for you like other fish. It just sits there. They can't do anything. So
yeah,
it's like a little buffet for sea turtles.
Ooh, how
other than straws, I guess.
How nice would that be that you just walk up and your food, like, it's just sitting there waiting for you. Your little old turtle.
Yeah, and you just stumble across a plate of cheeseburgers.
Yeah. Ooh, there we go. I love it. Okay, are you ready for my weird war story?
Yes, okay. I love war stories. The weirder the better, especially.
This one, in my opinion, is pretty weird. I heard it on another podcast recently, a little bit of the details, and I was like, oh my God, I have to go look that up. We're going back to 1941, and in 1941, the world was engulfed in war. A surprise attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7th caused the U.S. to enter that war. The U.S. began to rapidly ramp up not only conventional military strength, but covert operations, intelligence gathering, and psychological warfare. In June 1942, the U.S. government reorganized its wartime intelligence under a new umbrella agency called the OSS, or the Office of Strategic Services. And the OSS...
I don't like where this is going.
Well, the OSS eventually became the CIA. If that leads you to...
But the OSS did...
This is pretty
very shitty
this
stuff.
This is crazy. Just the thought
so
that anybody did this.
So back to a previous episode, the OSS were responsible for the Oswang in the Vietnam.
Oh, yes.
I think I told that.
You
that
did.
That might have been on, I think I told it on another podcast and on this one.
Could be
correctly
where they were They did
folklore from like vampires, yes. Basically Vietnamese vampires.
Yes.
Not
okay.
Dracula, but like it's very similar, and they would fly ahead, like, and play screeching noises because that's what the Oswong vampire thing sounded like, and yeah,
this that, is they did along some very strange those lines. Things. Yeah, this is along those lines. The OSS was formed to carry out espionage, sabotage, counterintelligence, propaganda, and other clandestine functions to support the Allied war efforts. The OSS employed thousands of operatives worldwide, aiming to gather information and damage enemy morale. Their focus was global, spanning Europe, North Africa, and Asia, basically everywhere that the Allied forces might exploit weakness in the enemy's resolve. That's where they were in their kind of tinkering around. As the war dragged on, and with Japan standing as a formidable adversary in the Pacific, the pressure grew to find new, unconventional ways to weaken Japanese resolve. Conventional bombing and planned invasion were being considered, of course, but the OSS was also considering another plan. To grasp what drove one of these ideas, we must dive into Japanese folklore. In Japan, the fox was more than an animal.
I know this story.
Yeah.
This story is so cool.
It also represented a spirit with supernatural powers. Fox in Japanese, I'm probably butchering the name. I did look it up how to pronounce it, but I still probably will not do it justice. Kitsune is Japanese for fox. Okay. You tracking?
Okay. Yeah. I have a question, but I don't want to spoil this story. So
okay.
Wait. Keep, and remind me.
Keep your question sure in mind. Traditional belief, the kitsune is not merely a wild animal. It's also a being capable of transformation, trickery, and delivering messages from the divine. Kitsune belong to a broader class of supernatural beings
called friendly ghost?
Yokai. Yes and no. It could be both.
Oof. Okay.
It could be both, which is part of the problem with this plan that we'll get to. Because sometimes it means good and sometimes it means scary. You choose, I don't know. It's weird.
Well, not to go off on too much of a tangent, but I play this game called Phasmophobia, and it's a ghost hunting game, and there's like 20 something different ghosts to choose from, and you have to collect evidence to figure out the ghost, and one of them is a yokai. But it's weird that I didn't know there was other things, like other factions, species.
Yokai is a yokai. Interesting. According to my research, is a classification of supernatural beings. So if you want to think about like fruit, apples and oranges are both fruit. But they're separate and apart.
Okay, that makes sense. It makes sense.
These entities, the yokai, blur the lines between nature, spirit, and the uncanny. Their powers often include shape-shifting, commonly into human form, extraordinary longevity, and magical abilities. In many tales, some foxes are benevolent and serve as guardians and messengers. These foxes were honored at shrines and often symbolized good luck, prosperity, and divine protection. But other stories portray kitsune as tricksters. These foxes were cunning and sometimes mean or spiteful. They could deceive humans, possess them, or lead them astray. Just like I said, good or bad, I don't know what makes that determination.
Just fucking with people.
Yeah. This folklore goes way back in Japanese history by centuries. Over generations, the Kitsune myth had woven it.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Itself into religion, art, stories, and popular belief. Because it represented both a good and bad symbol, the fox inspired both trust and dread. In 1943, someone within the OSS dared to propose a plan that today sounds ridiculous and unbelievable. Based on that folklore, they wanted to unleash glowing foxes in Japan.
So my question is, OSS, the precursor to the CIA, this isn't the first story that they've used a culture's folklore or religious beliefs. I mean, I don't think you can call that a religious belief, but like, using folklore. And so I wonder if the CIA still uses tactics like
cultural tactics. Like, that's a good question.
No, like cultural stuff, like, oh, these groups of rebels in this country that we need to overthrow
believe XYZ
scared of some weird Bigfoot monster, so we're gonna get a guy in a Sasquatch suit.
I think I wouldn't put it past them, but I think in today's society
they'll just use chemical weapons. Wipe them out.
I think that back in the 40s,
a bunch of fucking poison ticks on your head.
Back in the 40s, people thought everybody from Japan was all the same, and they would all believe whatever we tell them because they weren't looking into the culture that much. And maybe that's why they did it in Vietnam, where they did the whole vampire thing.
It was during the Vietnam conflict. Yeah. I can't remember which territory it was, but it was around there.
I think that maybe they've wised up a little bit and realized that people might live in the same country and identify as the same, you know, genetic makeup and race and everything, but they might not all believe the same cultural things. Maybe. I don't know.
Just like every other human being ever.
Yes.
Except for maybe North Korea.
Right. Like. Right. The someone in the OSS that wanted to start this program was Ed Salinger. He was a psychological warfare strategist. He had no military background. That's kind of important, I think. Before the war, Salinger ran an import-export business in Tokyo. He had some exposure to Japanese language, culture, their superstitions, and their folklore. That familiarity, however basic as it might have been, convinced OSS leadership to give his idea a try. They were like, oh, you know about Japanese culture, so you can help us figure this out.
What was his name again?
Ed Salinger.
Oh, the guy who did the Oswang, his name was Ed Lansdale.
Oh, okay. That would have been funny if it was the same guy.
It was the same guy. He's just like reading up on all this Asian folklore.
I'm guessing that Ed Salinger's tenure with the OSS probably went away after all of his suggestions. They were probably like, bro, you got to find a different job. We're not going to do this. No.
Also, radioactive things don't glow like in The Simpsons, I don't think.
Well, we're going to get there.
I mean,
because you have
you can
this
get
idea.
Uranium plates that glow under like UV lights. That's kind of because like old school uranium glass, it glows, but like you don't.
Yep.
Did Oh no, did they hit the foxes with UV lights and they glue?
No, I'll explain it. I'm gonna go into detail.
Okay.
Salinger believed that Japanese people were superstitious and their belief in evil spirits could be provoked. His plan was codenamed Operation Fantasia, and it aimed to use Japanese culture against them. Salinger's thinking was simple. Harness the cultural fear and superstition rather than bullets, bombs, or propaganda leaflets. Earlier proposals were abstract. One idea called for giant glowing balloons shaped as demonic creatures floating over Japanese cities and then incinerating within 15 minutes. They were just going to float some balloons over catch them on fire.
Someone let go of the Tweety Bird Macy's Parade float, and it's floating over Japan.
Exactly. This was in...
To be fair, I think...
I would be scared.
I would be more terrified by, like, something like that than if, like, enemy troops came in. I'd be more scared if they used, like, psychological warfare and made me see ghosts and shit.
Yeah, like, for sure.
That'd be way more terrifying.
The balloons were intended to be an eerie spectacle meant to terrify, but didn't directly involve the Kitsune myth. They wanted to bring in the culture, so they had another idea. Basically, they were like, oh, let's put some balloons over, but we got to stick to this fox thing, so let's scratch that balloon lighting on fire option, and let's stick with our glow-in-the-dark foxes.
Another thing, foxes are so, you hear fox, like, you know, we have them at our house.
It's freaky.
Like, you never see them. You hear them, but you rarely, very, very rarely see them. So that's going to affect maybe three people. Like, these foxes are just going to run off and hide.
Well, maybe if you had like 10, but they had a,
still,
they were going to do more than that.
They're not
word of mouth.
I don't think they're pack animals. Like,
I don't know.
I think that would be very highly ineffective. More people would see the balloon, so I feel like that would be more
effective. It would be. Because you could control the balloon, theoretically, and it's not going to run off and hide in a hole. Yeah. But whatever. Because the fox was already embedded in Japanese spiritual culture, they wanted to use it and make it serve as a weapon. Their next idea involved creating whistles that imitated fox cries, along with artificial fox scent sprays. You're gonna go up and smell a bunch of foxes and then make a cologne that smells like foxes. I don't know. It's ridiculous. Yeah. This was to simulate the presence of the supernatural foxes. I didn't know that supernatural foxes had a smell. But apparently in the OSS, they did. I don't know. Efforts to produce convincing illusions led the planners towards something more tangible. They wanted to use real animals because, I mean, a fox balloon's only going to get you so far, right? You want to sell this myth that these glow-in-the-dark foxes are coming after you. The strategy involved live foxes, but how do you make them look like ghostly spirits? Like you said, animals don't normally glow in the dark, and how do you make them glow in the dark? Mm-hmm. Well, you paint them with paint-containing radium, which is...
Oh, the shit that's in your watch? Oh.
A radioactive compound that...
Did we talk about the radium girls?
We have not.
Okay.
But this specifically had to do with that because later they learned how bad radium was because of the radium girls getting sick and dying and losing body parts because it came in contact with the radium paint. So for people, we'll cover it later, but as a very brief thing, radium paint is radioactive, and it was used a long time ago for glow-in-the-dark watches. And in order for them to paint the little tiny numbers inside of watches, the girls that were painting the watches, the face of the dial face of the watch, would lick the paintbrush and then
they'd lick it to get it wet,
paint it, put it in the paint, and then just
I wouldn't even do that with fucking watercolors.
No, it's gross. Like, it's gross, but you know, they it's
disgusting.
They did it, and then people found out that it bad thing happens. Yeah,
it's horrible for you.
The plan was to paint the foxes, then release them into Japanese villages and cities under cover of night. Because, of course, you know, you have to do it at night so they glow in the dark. Otherwise, they're just foxes. These glowing foxes were meant to...
Well, aren't foxes nocturnal, too?
Yes, they are. I've seen a few of them around dusk and early morning.
They kind of scatter around. Yeah. Never during the middle of the
night. Not typically, no. These glowing foxes were meant to be perceived as supernatural omens indicating doom. Before they could roll out the glowing army of foxes, they had to test the theory. First, they needed to determine if the radioactive paint would stick to animal fur. So they took a raccoon from the New York Zoo, painted him until he glowed. After several days of normal raccoon hijinks,
awesome.
The paint was still intact, so they moved forward. They were like, yes, okay, we tested the theory. The radium paint does stick to animal fur. The next part of the test was to see what your average observer would think of glow-in-the-dark animals. Would they be scared? I mean, that's definitely a question. Or would they just be like, well, that's weird. Why is that animal glowing in the dark? The OSS painted a group of 30 foxes and released them into a park in Washington, D.C. The theory was that if Americans were freaked out by the sight of glowing animals, then the Japanese, because of their culture, would surely be distraught. Several scared locals ran from the park and reported the ghostly animals. The OSS was pleased with their efforts, so they moved on to the next step.
If you saw a glowing raccoon, would you run away? I would run towards it. I'd be like, what the fuck is that?
Same. I'd be like, what? I'm not running screaming from a park because a bunch of glowing animals are running around. I would, but some people did.
I would immediately think someone drugged me.
Yes. But then I'd be like, oh.
Or I feel like it.
What?
I play enough video games, I think it was a quest. It's like, you gotta have to follow the animal and you're gonna...
Follow glowing fox to the next step.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. I would run towards it. But also, it's not in my culture that there's this ghost
right.
that looks like a fox.
A ghostly, so glowing fox.
Maybe you would think differently if you were Japanese.
Yes. So the next phase is, how do you get the glowing foxes to Japan? They figured they could throw a pack.
Airplane?
What? Airplane. No.
Airplane?
Not airplane. Boat. They figured they could throw a pack of painted foxes into the ocean and the foxes would swim to shore. But they had to test it because they weren't sure if a fox could swim long distances. So
the radiant paint fell off in the water.
They dumped a bunch of glowing foxes in the Chesapeake Bay. Turns out the foxes could swim to shore. So the foxes made it on shore. But by the time the foxes reached shore, most of the luminous paint had washed off. And then what do animals do when they get wet? They
shake.
And licked themselves, so they licked the rest of the paint off.
Oh.
So no more glowing fox.
Poisoned themselves too. Hmm.
The water launch was abandoned. They had to come up with another idea. The next idea was to take taxidermied foxes and float them. They went back to the balloons. They were going to float them using balloons or kites across Japanese cities and towns. but a stuffed glowing fox might not have been terrifying enough in Salinger's opinion. It just keeps getting crazier and crazier.
This is the
dumbest part and was probably what sealed the fate of this whole operation. Salinger suggested that that just the taxidermied foxes weren't going to be enough. He wanted to put a human skull on the fox head, give it a mechanical device so the jaw would open and close to make it look like it was talking. But wait, there's more. For extra scariness, he would drape a black cloth, painted with a glowing human skeleton. So you have a fox-human hybrid, but it's a taxidermied fox.
So he made a Halloween decoration you buy at Home Depot.
Yes.
And thought this would be scary enough.
Yes.
Okay.
He was sure this glow-in-the-dark human-fox hybrid would inspire terror in the hearts of Japanese citizens that would lead to an Allied forces win. If the floating taxidermied foxes didn't work, there was another idea. Salinger suggested getting Japanese citizens who were sympathetic to Allied forces to act crazy. He's just like, just make them act crazy. He wanted them to run around chanting about foxes to make it look like they were possessed by the spirit of the kitsune. Salinger was forgetting, or maybe he didn't know.
If you brought this dude to a museum where they had a T-Rex like on display, he would cower in the corner. What the fuck is this dude?
Yeah. This dude, who would be scared of that? I don't know what he was taking. He was taking something really good.
Jesus.
Maybe he didn't know that in Japanese culture, the kitsune could be both good and bad. So in reality, he's planning this elaborate scheme to glow-in-the-dark foxes when the people might have been like, oh, this is an omen that we're actually doing the right thing because the fox could be good or bad. He was just assuming that they would all think it was bad.
Jesus.
I don't know. Regardless of that, not everyone in the OSS agreed with these elaborate plans, and Operation Fantasia was eventually shelved before any more animals were covered in radioactive paint. Which is just a wild concept in and of itself to think you're going to paint animals with radioactive paint. But whatever. That's why I'm not a military strategist, because I would never think of doing that.
He didn't sound like he was one for long either.
Right? Couple of years he had that job, I think. And then they were like, bro, you got to go.
At least the Oswang was successful. Like,
yeah.
This was not. It actually did something.
But. It didn't go anywhere except probably poisoning some foxes. And
yeah.
Especially there's after they got out of the water and licked it off.
Chesapeake Bay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy. All right. Tell us about this monster.
About the Urals monster.
Okay.
Yes. On a quiet stretch in the Ural region of... Oh, restart that. On a quiet stretch of the Ural region in Russia in the late 1930s, when Soviet Union was tightening its grip on every corner of the public and private life, a series of crimes emerged that the state refused to believe could even happen. Crimes against children committed by another child.
This is
the story of Vladimir Georgievich Vinchevsky.
I don't... All right.
Did we do this one already?
No, but when you said monster, I thought it was going to be like a make-believe, like a Yeti or you know, a mythical thing.
You had the brutal. What did you...
I had the bizarre, but I had the brutal,
you know?
I know, but I didn't think it was going to be
You knew it was going to be bad. If okay. When I said monster.
I thought it was like a Yeti.
Can we explore his...
Okay, go ahead.
No, I wish it were a Yeti.
Yeah.
So Vladimir Georgievich Vinchevsky. I think that's the best pronunciation I could do with that name.
Okay.
But anyways, he was born on July 22nd, 1923 in Sverdlovsky, the city known as... Oh God, Russian words are so goofy. I feel like the Swedish chef's saying this shit. Yekaterinburg.
Okay.
Sure. By all outward appearances, he was an ordinary Soviet boy. His family was modest, living in crowded communal housing, surviving turbulent political purges, and adhering to strict social expectations in Stalinist life. There was no documented physical abuse, no severe poverty, no obvious trauma, and yet those who later examined his history noted that same early behavioral deviations that appear again and again in the lives of violent offenders. Truancy and isolation, cruelty to animals, theft and manipulation, and a fascination with power over the vulnerable.
Oh, I don't like this
I'm
guy.
Only guilty of one of those, truancy and isolation. However, these signs were largely invisible to neighbors and teachers. Soviet ideology demanded that children of the regime be strong, disciplined, and predictable, and adults often looked the other way when they weren't. By age 14, Vladimir's behavior had escalated. He was described as intelligent but emotionally cold, social enough to blend in but detached enough to hold secrets, and he had secrets. Vinchevsky's earliest known crimes began in 1938 when he was just 14 years old. At first, the incident seemed unrelated, children going missing or turning up injured in a sprawling industrial city where accidents were common and supervision was less than ideal. His first recorded victim was a young boy, only around six.
Oh.
Witnesses' testimony collected later suggests that Vladimir lured the child away by offering to show him a shortcut home.
Ugh.
Instead, he led them to a wooded area near a ravine. There, he strangled and left the body hidden under a bush.
How old would he have been at that time?
The killing was around 14.
Ugh, barf. Yeah. Hate this kid.
The killing was sudden, brutal, and opportunistic. It wasn't yet the ritualized behavior that would later define his attacks, but it revealed something unmistakable. Vinchevsky had discovered a sense of control, and he liked it.
Ugh. I don't like it.
Investigators initially treated the death as an accident, a fall perhaps, which I think we all have seen movies where people get strangled and they're looking at the body and there's going to be obvious signs of strangulation.
Yeah.
So how, anyways, it's Russia. They probably didn't get paid enough to actually care. Like, okay, boy in the woods.
Yep.
That wasn't Russian at all. That was
well, they probably wouldn't have even considered another child.
This boy
did it, you know?
But I would have suspected a human. He's strangled and hidden under a bush. It's not an accident.
You right.
Just happened
he
to
crawled.
Choke yourself under a bush.
Yeah, he crawled underneath that bush and just died. I mean, if you just say it's an accident, then you don't have to investigate it.
True.
And
they're not getting paid enough. They're getting, here are your beats, sir.
Well, you know, this is how many hundred years ago? This was over 100 years ago, right?
No, it was in the 1930s.
Sorry.
So almost. Okay. Getting close.
Almost 100 years ago.
Late 30s, I believe.
When I think, you know,
so
police investigations from that time were like, oh, there's a dead person.
They didn't the know end. Anything. Yeah. Especially if it's a small town or something.
Right.
So 2 months later, another boy vanished. This time, the child survived just long enough to tell a fragment of what happened. He had been lured by an older teen with light hair, taken into an abandoned lot, and attacked. He described strangulation. his assailant's knee pressed against his chest, and a coldness in the boy's demeanor as if he was observing an insect.
Ew.
That's how the boy described it.
I hate this kid.
The victim died of his injuries a day later. Once again, authorities assumed an adult perpetrator mm-hmm. was responsible. They canvassed labor camps, questioned recently released prisoners, and checked mental hospitals for escaped patients. But none matched the description this boy had given.
Right, because it was a child.
By the winter of 1938, Vinchevsky's methods began to stabilize into a recognizable pattern. He targeted young children, usually boys, all between 4 and 10 years old. He selected victims from courtyards, stairwells, and playgrounds near state housing blocks. He was careful, and this is basically his MO.
Yeah.
He would approach the child, soft-spoken, non-threatening, and cleanly dressed, often to play with him, help him, just kind of help him run errands, do anything to get him to come with him. Choose a secluded location, forest, empty construction sites, riverbanks. He would subdue the victim using strangulation and sometimes sexually assault them and then stage or conceal the body to make it look like an accident or something. I don't know. Each crime created only more confusion for authorities. They believed they were tracing the trail of a dangerous adult maniac. The idea that a schoolboy could be hunting children was unthinkable.
Right.
Between 1938 and 1939, a clear chronology of Vyshinsky's known crimes emerges. Soviet investigators later reconstructed timelines based on survivor testimony, police logs, and internal reports. Summer of 1983 was his first murder, a young boy approximately 6 years old. That's the one we talked about. The second one, boy around 5 or 6, dies after surviving long enough to describe his attacker. November of that year, child escapes after being choked into unconsciousness, but he wasn't able to clearly describe Vyshinsky to the police. Basically, they're just getting a teenage boy, blonde, thin, acted very calm.
Oh, that's creepy.
December of that year, third confirmed murder. Child disappears after being seen walking with an older boy. His body was discovered in the snow at a construction site. January of 1939, the fourth murder happened. This killing is more violent than the earlier ones. So he had, normally he would just strangle him and leave him, but he beat the boy too.
Ugh.
In February of that year, there was another failed attempt where he started fighting with the boy and the boy was able to escape mid-attack.
Oh, okay.
And this kid was able to point out a suspect.
Okay.
Who he had seen. So he went to the police and they started going around town and he saw Vyshinsky sitting near a courtyard in an apartment complex.
Oh,
and so police approached him.
Creepy that would be.
For the first time, a 14-year-old, 14-year-old kid just.
Yeah. You're just walking around.
For the first time,
you see the guy. Oh.
So despite previous testimony from victims, authorities started to consider the possibility of a juvenile defender after this kid pointed him out.
Right.
But higher-ups resisted the idea.
Of course they did.
It was kind of because of Soviet pressures. They were like, children are the future. They can only do good.
Right.
So I think that it was like a weird situation. And no one would expect a 14-year-old kid to be a serial killer.
Exactly. Even if it happened today, people would still question it. I think people would be more inclined to believe it than back then, because especially Russia was so closed off with the information that they were telling people, they didn't even want to admit to themselves when they had a serial killer. They're definitely like, no, that's not that we would never have that. We're better than that. They're definitely not considering that a kid was doing any of this.
Is doing it. Yeah, it's awful.
Yeah.
So police obviously noted him down as a suspect, but didn't have any. I don't know if
reason to detain him.
Laws are different. I'm sure the laws. Yeah,
for
they
sure.
Didn't arrest him for whatever reason. But in March of that year, a couple of months after that, a 5-year-old was found strangled near a riverbank. Snow around the body reveals small footprints, not adult shoes, which led police to believe that it was the 14-year-old that
finally
the previous victim had pointed out. Yeah. So Vinchensky's arrest was quiet. Plainclothes officers simply approached him on his way home from school and asked him to come in for questioning. Witness reports say the boy remained eerily calm, even cooperative. Inside the interrogation room, he behaved like a child being scolded for skipping class, not being accused of murder.
Murder, yeah.
When investigators asked whether he knew why he had been brought in, he answered, because of the children.
Oh.
Wasn't a confession so much as an acknowledgement, a matter-of-fact statement delivered without remorse, but his questioning continued. His lack of emotional response unsettled the Soviet police, which is I'm sure hard to do.
Yeah.
But his parents were stunned. They had never suspected him. Neighbors were in disbelief because he was just a normal, quiet kid walking around. Seemed mild-mannered.
Right.
But, yeah.
Oof.
So Vinchensky's case was presented a unique challenge to the Soviet system. He could not be sentenced to death. The minimum execution age at the time was 18, and a public trial was out of the question for whatever reason. I'm sure they do it differently over there.
Because you got to keep that shit under lock and key. Stalinist ideology
insisted. Yeah. I don't want people to know. They're going to start freaking out.
Yeah.
Stalinist ideology insisted that criminal deviants, especially sexual predators, existed only in capitalist societies. So this...
Right. It's a Western thing.
Belief at the time, but...
Yeah.
For a 15-year-old Soviet citizen... Well, I guess... Oh, we don't have murders and rapists here. That's just America.
Yes.
Because they...
100%.
Wanted us to hate each
That's
other.
That's what they thought.
That makes sense. For a 15-year-old Soviet citizen to commit sexual murders... was a contradiction of the state would not allow to be seen.
Mm-mm.
So authorities handled this case internally. Within weeks of his arrest, he was transferred to a psychiatric facility for evaluation. Soviet medical examiners diagnosed him with a combination of psychopathy and sexual perversion, diagnoses that were almost never allowed to enter public records.
Right.
His young age made him both an anomaly and an embarrassment. Rumors circulated within law enforcement that pressured psychiatrists to declare him mentally unfit for trial, not because they believed it, but because it prevented any public proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what they do with pedophiles in the U.S. They're like, oh, we're going to throw it under grand jury and no one can see the court records because it's a grand jury.
It's all hush hush.
I got to bring it up every couple episodes how much I hate grand juries. The officials... consequence was a placement in a secure psychiatric institution, the Soviet equivalent of indefinite commitment. There's little reliable documentation describing his time there, but accounts from medical staff suggest he remained calm, detached, and largely emotionless, which it sounds like he was the whole fucking time.
The whole time.
He never stood trial, never appeared before a judge, or faced public reckoning.
Wow.
And within a few years, the state would erase his existence from newspapers, criminal archives, and official reports.
Yikes.
Yeah. So.
That is just amazing.
It's a horrible story.
I don't like it. I don't like it.
Yeah.
I need,
you have a chaser for us?
I do. I need a palate cleanser chaser. Yeah. Have you, you've probably seen the stuff. It's all over my Instagram about the 88-year-old veteran who was given a GoFundMe campaign to help him retire. Have you not seen it? Okay. Ed Bombas.
I've seen it. I've seen it.
That's my chaser. Cause I think it's amazing that for anybody who doesn't know, this gentleman who 88 years old was in the US military and had a really bad string of luck when the company that he retired from filed bankruptcy and he lost his retirement plan. Yes. GM. Yeah. The fact that that company still exists and could take this man's retirement away from him is just despicable. But we're here to talk about the positive part, not the thing that makes me want to pull my hair out in frustration. This guy lost his wife and was very heavily in debt, and a TikToker got him on GoFundMe, and in less than like 3 days, there was already $1.5 million donated for his retirement fund. So he finally gets to retire. It's so cool. It's just amazing that it happened that quickly in just a few days. And I just looked at it today, the day we're recording this. This will be a few days before this episode comes out. This morning I looked at it and it was over $1.8 million. Just from people making small donations.
I love to get high and watch those type of like reels or shorts or YouTube videos where just like another good one is Victor the Good Boss. He goes around to like Massachusetts area and gets homeless people off the streets, and like he owns a company, so he'll like get them clean and then hire them.
That's
awesome. And give them a job and stuff. And he'll like post updates, and it's like all his employees are people from his videos and stuff, and it's super cool.
But that is cool.
I love watching those types of videos.
Feel good stuff.
Like just people using their internet money for good.
Yes.
Like it's very, very entertaining.
Yeah, for sure.
But
what's your chaser?
So my chaser is a callback to your story.
Okay.
It's a World War II story.
Oh.
Is it? Wait. Yeah, World War II. Okay. I'm going to be talking about Sergeant Siwash.
Sergeant Siwash.
Sergeant Siwash was a female duck that was named after a nickname for Sergeant Jack Cornelius. She was originally believed to be a male duck until she laid eggs.
Oh, whoops.
Siwash was won at a raffle in New Zealand by Sergeant Francis Fagan. Siwash became the mascot of the 2nd Marine Division.
Wow.
In June 1943.
That's amazing.
She was popular because she drank beer like her owner, like your cat. Hemi likes to drink beer.
She does.
So she was noted to dislike draft beer and only drank beer if it was warm.
Oh, okay.
Siwash was brought to the invasion of Tarawa, where she proceeded to find and attack a Japanese rooster, getting injured in the process.
Okay.
The Marines considered awarding her with a Purple Heart for this, but she was instead given a citation for bravery. Her citation read, for courageous action and wounds received on Tarawa in the Gilbert Islands, November 1943, with utter disregard for his own personal safety, Siwash, upon reaching the beach without hesitation, engaged the enemy in fierce combat, namely one rooster of Japanese ancestry.
This is hilarious.
And thought wounded on the head by repeated pecks. He soon routed the opposition. He refused medical aid until all wounded members of his section had been taken care of. She was also brought to the Battle of Saipan and the Battle of Tinian, where she captured a Japanese duck.
Oh.
After World War II, she temporarily lived on a farm in California. She later was re-enlisted to help recruit soldiers sell war bonds during the Korean War.
Okay.
She was eventually relocated to the Lincoln Park Zoo and died on May 2nd, 1954 due to liver disease. Marine veterans said that her liver disease had no connection to her fondness for beer.
Sure, it didn't.
A funeral for Siwash was held in a taxidermy shop. Her body was stuffed and presented to the National Museum of the Marine Corps in Virginia.
That, there needs to be a movie about that.
I know.
That, I would watch that 100%.
Oh, gosh. I would watch that, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Warm. My goodness, that's awesome.
Yeah. When you said your story is about World War II, I had to switch up my chaser.
I like it. That was a great chaser.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. Yes. It was good talking to you, Mom, hearing your interesting story. Yes. I knew, like, I heard the basics of that, but mm-hmm. I didn't know the full details. So it was
cool to hear that. I had to look it up because it was so ridiculous.
Yeah. Have you been getting a bunch of reels and shorts for it too, like I have been?
No. Not yet.
Oh, I saw that on a reel and I was considering doing it, but
oh,
I forgot about it. But you did a better job because I couldn't find much more than just a couple reels talking about it.
Oh, yeah. So I looked up some stuff.
Yeah. All right. Love you, Mom.
Love you too, bud. Bye.
Hey, friends. Thank you for supporting our podcast. Please share our show with your brutal and bizarre friends. Give us a boozy follow on your favorite podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating or review as well. But maybe do that sober so all the letters are in the right place.
You can find all our contact information in the show notes. We love hearing from you, and if you're interested in helping us stock the bar for our future boozy episodes, you can find our Patreon link in the show notes as well.